I'm just going to remind us, this is Andy Warhol, His Legacy. It's a four-week lecture program. Last week, Dr. Thistlethwaite, who, of course, is the Kay and Velma Kimball chair at TCU, is teaching this course. And last week, he put Andy Warhol in context of pop art. He did a beautiful job. And this week, he's going to talk about, obviously, Warhol's alchemy, advertising art, advertising, which I think should be really interesting. Our speaker last night, Ben Jones, for the Tuesday evening lecture, said that if he wasn't busy installing, he would come in to hear this because he thought it sounded so fascinating. So I think we're in for a real treat. I am not going to formally introduce Dr. Thistlethwaite every week. I did last week. But I do invite you to go to TCU's faculty website because it gives you a bio that kind of tells you just how fortunate we are to have him here with us each week. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mark.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to see so many of you again here. Let's see. Lights. As Terry said, and as you can see, I wanted today to focus on the connection between pop art and advertising very generally, and the connection between Andy Warhol and advertising very specifically, because I think it's a really fascinating connection, and it's also an essential part of pop art. It's something that was there from the very beginning, even before the beginning, when pop art was, as I mentioned briefly last week, being sort of previewed, almost, we might think of it, in the mid-1950s in Britain, as young British artists were looking at American popular culture and clipping out pictures and creating collages. They were taking largely those images from advertising. It was advertising that particularly caught their eye. And I mentioned last week that the term pop art was, I think I gave the wrong date, actually. I think I said 1954. It was 1956. When two British architects, Allison and Peter Smithson, in an article entitled "Today We Collect Ads," used the term pop art. So it's advertising is fundamental to pop art. Richard Hamilton, who was a British pop artist in 1957, defined what he thought as pop art. And again, this is before it really is known all the time by that term. It's still being developed. But he says it's popular. That means for a mass audience. It's transient, short-term solution or satisfaction. It's expendable, easily forgotten, low-cost, mass-produced, young, that is aimed at youth, witty, sexy, gimmicky, glamorous, and big business, all of which could be also adjectives for advertising. And again, that I think that's part of the really tight connection between the two. With Warhol, it's very much a embedded connection because he does, in fact, as most of you know, began in the 1950s as what was called a commercial artist at the time. We'd call graphic designer. But he began doing illustrations that were commissioned by magazines like Vogue, Glamour, Mademoiselle, 17, and others, as well as advertising campaigns illustrating them for, in particular, I. Miller Shoes, a campaign that ran for about 5 years, and it was a very successful campaign. When he begins to make his move to becoming an artist, and that was always something he wanted to do. He wanted to be a fine artist, not a commercial artist. He immediately starts working in the realm that he's familiar with, and that's advertising. And these are two of his early works. They're both large paintings. The one on the left is about 5.5 feet across, and the one on the right's even slightly bigger. And it is a black and white image, just as you see here. But in the one on the left, for instance, you can see that even without knowing the source, that it it certainly looks as though it's taken from a newspaper or a magazine advertisement, that particularly one you might see at the back of a magazine, where there'd be a whole slew of advertisements about health products and wigs and shoes that would make you taller and things that would make you more muscular and so forth. The work on the right, before and after, is referring to cosmetic surgery, and this is a work that was taken very specifically from a source that we're familiar with. Let me see, I have this. Well, I don't know why it's... At any rate, this is the National Enquirer, and if you look at the left column, about halfway up, on the image on the left, you can see the very tiny source that he used for this, what ended up being quite a large painting. So of all the images here, that's the one he picks. There's a muscular guy here that's not unlike the ad or painting we just saw before. So he's transitioning into becoming an artist, but he really is transitioning in the sense that he's still got one foot in the advertising world. And in fact, he's going to continue to do advertising illustrations for into the early 60s when he finally will stop, although my argument will be that he never really stops because it's so much part of what his thinking about visual imagery is. And ultimately, he'll make no distinction between the two. And in fact, in his book published in 1980 called Popism, which I highly recommend, it's the one Warhol book that's really understandable and also extraordinarily informative, in large part because it was written by someone else, even though he's listed as the major artist. But Pat Hackett did a terrific job. But in that book, Warhol declares that, basically for him and pop artists in general, I think, commercial art is the same as real art, and real art is the same as commercial art. So he really sees the two, although they're functioning differently, ultimately, as far as he's concerned, they're not. This is an early moment in what in the next decade, the 70s, and then later, will become referred to as the commodification of art, the idea of thinking about artworks as commodities, which takes on a very negative character and leads to institutional critiques and so forth in the 70s and 80s. But Warhol is someone who is perfectly fine with looking at this world of everyday advertising and bringing it into works of art. But like any artist, he's selecting his subject matter, he's transforming that subject matter, and he's presenting it, at least in this case on the right, as a work of art. Sort of intriguingly, but in some ways not at all surprising, this work on the right, which you can see... sorry, this doesn't seem to work, as I said. The slide on the left-hand side on the far right of it is this particular painting. It first appeared in a window display in an advertising situation. In other words, he was commissioned to create a window for Bonwit Teller, a store in New York City, which prided itself, still does, on its window displays. And it was really the first time he showed what becomes his pop artworks. He showed five paintings. One was of Superman. One was a Pepsi-Cola ad. One was a much more abstracted work. And then one other comic book, Popeye, on the far right-hand side. But this is the first public showing, essentially, of his new stage of art. And it takes place in a window. It takes place in a very public area and one that is given over to advertising the store, to advertising this particular dresses. He sets it up and he designs it. He sets it up like a gallery, though, which, again, is sort of fascinating to think about because these works have not been seen in a gallery. He intends them to be, but he's sort of, making it happen by using the street as part of the gallery itself. So this combination of his work coming out of advertising based on a illustration in National Enquirer, turning into a painting, and then showing up in connection with advertising is what I'm referring to in the title as Warhol's alchemy, this transition that it ultimately becomes circular in nature and something that's going to hold true throughout his career. Other pop artists obviously are also looking at advertising. As I said, it's really inbred in the nature of pop art itself. But no one except for Lichtenstein quite does this circular move, advertising art, advertising, as Warhol does. You're looking at a large painting about the size of the slide, the lower image, by James Rosenquist, completed in 1961. They came back and reworked it a little bit in 64. Above it, vastly increased in scale relative to the painting, are three bits of popular culture that Rosenquist used as his point of departure for the painting. One was an election flyer for John Kennedy. The other was a cake recipe advertisement. And the third was a Chevrolet advertisement. And these are things he cut out of magazines, pasted using masking tape, it looks like, or scotch tape, and put them into collage form that then was his point of departure. And like Warhol and like Lichtenstein and like the other pop artists, even though they were charged with simply plagiarizing imagery that was out there, not making any changes, you can see he makes changes. I mean, Kennedy is in black and white in the poster. He's in color. The cake, it goes the other direction. The car is modified, too. It'd be hard to identify what kind of car it really was. So my point is that there are changes that occur. And, of course, the scale is much different. I mean, it's like a mini billboard, which is appropriate for Rosenquist, who had worked as a billboard painter, and his work often is characterized as almost a billboard in transition from going up and coming down. This is at a time when billboards were still being painted by sign painters, and that's what Rosenquist did for many years in the 50s up until 1959. But like Warhol, he took that background in advertising, essentially, and then begins to modify it and use it in his painting. Again, a connection between advertising. This is one that's in every book on pop art, between advertising and a painting. The painting by Roy Lichtenstein on the right, which again is, like most pop paintings, a substantial sized painting. It's about 5 feet high. And on the right-hand side, what would have been a very small advertisement that until very recent years, it still may be, but for a long, long time, decades literally, this advertisement for a Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania honeymoon resort was in the New York Times Magazine, among other places, every Sunday. And he's clipped that and used that as his source. Once again, you can see the changes that he makes. He had, you know, again, to color, he crops the figure, he changes the hair, the ball has stripes on it. He has this background that I think we read it because she looks like she's obviously in a swimsuit, that they look like waves in the background, but this is supposedly referencing the mountains of Pennsylvania, so they could be read as mountains, I suppose, a lake surrounded by mountains as well.
Do you need a pointer?
Yes.
The battery's not good.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt.
This is it, right? Or should I use that one?
No, this one's dead, too. I'll put some batteries in this and set it next to you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Sean. This is a work that comes full cycle like Warhol's. And as I mentioned, Lichtenstein's the one other artist, pop artist, where this happens. This is, if you go to New York right now, I assume, because this photograph's taken fairly recently, if you stand across the street from the Museum of Modern Art on 53rd Street and look at their bookstore, in the window are advertising signs featuring this work, which is part of the collection of the museum. So it makes sense that it would be there. But it's very much functioning as an advertisement. So again, it comes out of a newspaper advertisement, it's transformed into a painting, and then ends up as a reproduction, as a poster. And in fact, each of the posters, although they're identical, except the language is different. Each one represents a different language, indicating the very diverse audience that the Museum of Modern Art attracts to the various exhibitions it has. And Lichtenstein's work also, like Warhol's, has a tremendous impact on advertising. So there's this, again, symbiotic relationship of pop artists taking from the world of advertising and then advertising pulling from the world of pop art. On the upper part of the screen is a work of Lichtenstein's from 1965. I brought it in just as a kind of classic example of Roy Lichtenstein's work with the Bende dots and his references to comic book imagery. Thanks, John. And the idea that it really is an image of an image. It's a painting of an image. It's quite a large painting once again. Below is an ad from 1983, and particularly during the 80s and 90s. And then there's been a recent revival, I think, of interest in Lichtenstein's type of pop art. And I say that because even though you might argue, well, it's based upon the same comic imagery, comic book or comic strip imagery that Lichtenstein was looking at, and it's parallel, it's not the same. But in fact, you often find the word pop appearing, which is the giveaway that the connection is to pop art, that they're really thinking about not comic books, but art, high art. And one of the points that I'll be making several times is, and again, something we're all familiar with and don't too often think about.
Sorry to interrupt again.
That's okay. Is the impact of painting on advertising and advertising's referencing to a number of art movements as well. So this is in the title, the pop. I have to, every time I see that, I want to say Polish, and I know that's not right. Polish. And it's because Warhol was, family was from Czechoslovakia, I guess that comes to my mind. But it also down here talks about you bring on the flash, the dazzle, and the pop with a capital P. So the reference clearly is to pop art. And then just by way, again, it's not a one-to-one relationship at all, but the standard that Lichtenstein presents in one of the classic pop paintings by him in the collection here, fortunately, Mr. Bellamy from 1961, and on the right, a very recent, couple of years ago, local Fort Worth Goodwill annual report, which the whole brochure was presented as a kind of pop work of art. So that reference once again to pop art rather than to advertising. But it is, again, advertising, which is the source, is the beginning point. And I bring in this ad from 1962, a Campbell's soup with the soup cans that are going to be so influential on Andy Warhol, and he's going to take that out of the ad and then make it into a work of art. So he transforms that popular culture image, that consumable good, that commodity, that advertising form into a work of art, which is then ultimately recycled back into advertising, even after Warhol's gone. Andy Warhol dies in 1987. In 2004, Campbell's Soup issues a limited edition, which I'm sure means several million, soup cans to the design of Andy Warhol, and which feature an image of Warhol, a late image, not Andy Warhol of the Campbell's Soup era, but Andy Warhol of the Fright Wig era, which is a kind of scary thing to put on a can. Domestic, you know, warm, fuzzy food. But these psychedelic colors, which again are Warhol in the mid-60s, really, conditioning these. And in fact, in 1999, the Warhol estate entered into an agreement with the Campbell Soup Company for licensing. And Campbell Soup has licensed all sorts of things from the Andy Warhol estate, which is, you know, without knowing a whole lot of legal issues, it always seems bizarre to me that Campbell Soup has to license the image from Andy Warhol, who stole it from Campbell Soup. But that's part of the wonderful enigma of Andy Warhol, I think, of what he got away with. This is, you can't read this from where you are, but I couldn't resist bringing it in. It's a letter from the marketing manager of Campbell Soup, and it's dated 1964, and he says, I've followed your career for some time. You know, Warhol's probably thinking, uh-oh, here comes the lawsuit I've been waiting for. Your work has evoked a great deal of interest here at Campbell Soup Company for obvious reasons. At one time, I hoped to acquire one of your Campbell Soup label paintings, but I'm afraid you've gotten much too expensive for me. I did want to tell you, however, that we admired your work and have since learned that you like tomato soup. I'm taking the liberty of having a couple of cases of our tomato soup delivered to you at your address. We wish you continued success and good fortune. Of course, Campbell's Soup got just an incredible amount of free advertising because of what Warhol did with that product of theirs. And they marketed it as well, even in the 60s before there was an Andy Warhol estate. This is a super dress from 1966. It was one of several dresses and suits, men's suits made in the 60s of paper for some reason. It was thought paper was a great idea for a suit. And as James Rosenquist, who had a suit designed and made of paper, when it rained, he didn't have a suit. It was a real problem. But at any rate, you find this advertisement that is indicating that the Campbell Soup Company, long a focus for many pop art trends. So they're really aligning themselves with this fine art movement. You know, not just the soup can, but many trends of the pop art movement is bringing pop art to the world of high fashion with the super dress. And it's made of 80% cellulose and 20% cotton. And it gives you information about it. It says it's fire resistant unless washed or cleaned. So it's definitely a throwaway a kind of object. I'm sorry these slides are dark. On the right-hand side is a, it's very hard to see in this image, but inside this clothing store, very chic store in Chelsea, in New York, in the Chelsea area, if you were to go inside and walk up the stairs to the main showroom, it's a fashion store, a clothing store. These are all, it's actually like vinyl reproductions of soup cans lining the steps, the risers of the steps, and actually at the very top is a stack of Campbell's soup cans. So this is 2009, and this advertising dimension is still being used. So again, going from the painting to this, and again, they're referencing Warhol. They're not referencing Campbell's Soup Company itself. It's the connection to Warhol. This is a little bit better. They wouldn't let me come inside and take a photograph, so I attracted much more attention by standing outside taking photographs than I would have if I'd been inside. But at any rate, you can see this stairway of soup cans and then the stack, which serves as the base for the mannequins to stand on. Again, a real incredible kind of connection, I think, to Warhol. This architectural use, as it were, of soup cans, which is really, this is small pickings compared to what the National Gallery of Scotland had done just 2 years earlier when it hosted an Andy Warhol retrospective exhibition and covered its classical columns with soup can vinyl again once more. It was very popular. And, of course, it's really serving an advertising purpose. It's, you know, people right away know this is not an exhibition of Campbell's Soup. It's an exhibition of Andy Warhol's work. And for as I was talking a little bit about the soup can last week, it's the work that he's so identified with. Even though this was a retrospective and it covered his entire career, they chose that. It made more sense than putting Marilyn around the columns because of the stacked quality of the cans. But it became a very popular site for people to gather and, of course, have their picture taken with it. It just seems so kind of funny. But it's a real visual confirmation that the soup can has become a classical object. A classical icon. It's, you know, literally serving that purpose in terms of this neoclassical building. And, of course, it is presenting the object of everyday life, the object of advertising, the object of consuming it as a work of art in an art gallery, looking at it in that environment and that context, which is a fundamental transformation that occurs in Warhol's work. I couldn't help but thinking of, I've come across some wonderful advertisements from the 40s and 50s, not as often as I would like to find them, but these are two that particularly stand out, where companies are advertising their products basically as works of art. In other words, they're playing off the cachet of fine arts and all that that entails, eliteness, wealthy collectors, museums, the world of connoisseurship, the world of money, and so forth. So to link your project, to put it in a frame as, you know, in the Schlitz ad for, you know, their beer now becomes this still life painting, which it's hard to read the caption, but it says, the man is saying, now here's something I understand. You know, thank goodness I don't have to look at this Jackson Pollock or the Mondrian, or Lord knows what that is. But there's this beer, and that resonates with me. Or The Art of Better Living. This is done right at the, still World War II is going on, and it's talking about the war coming to an end and the future is going to be fulfilled by all these promises that were made through technology before the war. So these Westinghouse products, which are all framed along here, where the man, you know, suitably positioned body language-wise, like you're in a museum, hat off, leaning forward, and the woman in ecstasy, of course, over, you know, what's going to become available to her. And in the copy, they refer to these masterpieces of Westinghouse. So the art connection is played up. And you notice here, there's a velvet rope. I mean, these are so fine art that you can't get close to it at all. So it's this idea of associating advertising product with artwork is part of the advertising world of really of the 20th century. But again, what Warhol does is to literally make it happen. In other words, he takes the product, he does frame it, it does end up in a museum or a gallery. So this kind of, you know, fantasy world becomes reality. There seems to be very little transition between the look of the painting that Warhol does and the object being advertised, which is what upset so many people, so many critics at the time, that there was no difference between the look of the advertising object and the look of the painting. There were some differences, obviously. We've talked about scale and color and so forth. But fundamentally, it did look like what they were representing, which was part of their intention. And that was a huge argument when the symposium on pop art was held, the first one in the very end of 1962 at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. That was the major question, was how can this really be art? Isn't it just an advertising image? And, you know, that's continued. You see it today. Go back for a second. Yeah. in the middle, in Warhol's own time, well, both of these in his own time, but 1965, right during the pop movement, Olivetti, which has a long history in the 20th century, literally from 1904 on, of doing very avant-garde advertising and often employing artists to create the imagery for their advertising, sets up their latest line of typewriters, portable typewriters, as a gallery situation, almost like to a closet Oldenburg oversized object hanging on the wall in this immense, what's called the Valentine typewriter below. This ad that was in Texas Monthly in 1982, where, again, the carpet is so beautiful it comes framed. And, you know, here, apparently, it's okay to touch the work of art, you know, because it's a carpet. But it clearly set up as these works of art. And this is the question that came up over and over again. What's the difference between this idea of thinking of the project and advertising it as a work of art, and then actually painting it and showing it as a work of art? Oh, it's going to jump, I bet. No. It's a really terrible illustration ad, I think. But it makes my point. I think this is in the Dallas Morning News in 86. Again, you know, the idea that credit cards are works of art and can be framed and, you know, you would look at it, it's a limited edition and so forth. This 86, Warhol had already dealt with this. He had already dealt with the idea of the work of art being essentially currency, the idea that art had value. Well, why not just paint money? And as Warhol one time made the comment, you know, I shouldn't even be painting money. I should just hang it on the wall. You know, that's all you need to do. Put a frame around it and stick, you know, bills on the wall. So as early as 62, he was painting dollar bills. In the mid-80s, he moved and did a whole series of very large dollar signs. And in a sense, again, it's this connection with the idea that the product is being presented as art that's being sold. Well, why just not skip a step and just say, okay, this is valuable. This is, you're buying this for commodity purposes. And again, that was one of the things that was disturbing as well as sort of liberating, I think, in his idea. I brought this in because thinking about the dollar sign in a museum, it looks like an S, but it's a dollar sign. You don't see this very often in museums. The Walters is one of the few places I've ever seen it. You know, it's like if you've got questions or you need to use the restroom or you want earphones, and then, you know, are they giving away money? No, it's the ATM. Is where you go. But Warhol sort of, you know, his dollar sign enters the museum 20 years before that. So, again, he's, as usual, ahead of the curve. Once again, just to reinforce his background in advertising, this is a maquette for an ad he did for I. Miller Shoes, typical of what he was doing in the mid-1950s, to great success. He was, you know, winning awards and making lots of money as an illustrator. And then, again, this transformation begins to take place, this alchemy, where the diamond dust shoes, they're called that because they're prints that he sprinkled diamond dust into the mix. He returns to the idea of shoes. And then that, in turn, leads to the use of the shoes in a Halston ad in 1981. So again, that coming from advertising, moving into painting, moving back into advertising, or just skipping the art step and making the advertising art in and of itself. He does a number of works on commission in the 1980s, such as these, the large poster that was in the Parisian Metro in 1983 for Perrier, a work that was created for that purpose and actually ended up winning the grand prize for poster design in France 1983. It was so popular. And then his Absolute Vodka in 1985, that campaign that, you know, I think is still going on, where hundreds of artists have participated, it began with Warhol. Warhol was the first artist that they commissioned to start what was a very successful campaign and help launch this brand of vodka, which was not that well known until it was associated with Warhol, with his imagery, and other artists got on board after that. So here he creates work that is often also reproduced in posters as well. So it's, again, gone through a number of transformations. Or you'll come across advertisements that include a Warhol as part of the set. The setting, and again, it's the use of fine arts to reinforce the prestige of what's being advertised. Holiday Inn, Crown Plaza, in the background is one of Warhol's, and they bring it forward and identify it as such, one of his flower paintings. And these, you know, two guys are giving up happy hour just to look and talk about the flower paintings. They're so impressed by it, and of course, it talks about, you know, raising service to an art. I mean, there's always that terrible pun that's going to show up within these ads. Or this Vogue magazine I Magnan ad in 1974, where the model, and there are a number of fashion ads that have Warhol imagery in them, the model holding on to or touching this. It's actually a screen print from his 1967 series of Marilyn portraits. You see another one sort of, you know, she's clutching off to the side there. And we don't too often think about it, but that image of Marilyn, which is, of course, represented in the collection here in the 25 colored Marilyns, that image, the beginning point, comes from a publicity still, which means advertising. So it comes, again, right out of advertising, and then he transforms it into painting. In 67, he does a whole portfolio of prints of Marilyn, which really are the way that that image gets distributed and widely known. And then it ends up back in advertising once again. This is a recent and in some ways really awful example, but I love it. Where it's hard to see, but it says, Warhol had Marilyn, Tommy's has the burger. And, you know, it's painted in the variety of colors, including a sort of off-putting green hamburger bun. I suppose it's the St. Patrick's Day special. But basing it upon, again, the idea of the fame, the celebrity of the Marilyn image, and also somewhat of the style as well. Whoops. It's an intriguing photograph, I think, on the left-hand side. It's a very unknown painter who was actually a second-generation abstract expressionist named James Harvey. He was also, by day, a commercial artist. And it was Harvey who redesigned the Brillo box in 1961 to the design that Warhol latched on and turned into his boxes in 1964. But it struck me that these two images really are rather similar, because it's almost like James Harvey on the left he's actually holding up a real Brillo box, but it almost looks like he's holding up an Andy Warhol Brillo box, in the same kind of relationship that the model is holding up or holding on to an Andy Warhol work. This, in fact, was also Harvey's photograph was used as an advertisement for an exhibition he was having in Detroit at this moment. He seems to be wanting to let people know that he was the one that designed the Brillo box, not Andy Warhol. But certainly Warhol becomes known for it. And this is one of the dozens and dozens and dozens of Brillo boxes. In 1964, Warhol built well over 100 boxes that were resembling cartons. He made them out of wood, plywood, and they were screen printed. But Brillo was only one of them. There were Campbell's soup boxes and Heinz boxes and other kinds of boxes as well. But the Brillo box is how we usually refer to almost all of them. And the opening of these works occurred in the Stable Gallery in New York in 1964. And you see the very important collector of pop art, Robert Scull, on the left-hand side, looking sort of quizzical. And then people at the opening, they all look like they just got off the bus and somehow wandered into this gallery. And no one's quite sure what to do. You know, these people think they're pretty cool, I guess, because they've kind of wandered out in the middle. These guys don't even realize it's art they're leaning on. It could be the loading dock for all they know. And again, that was a kind of criticism and also what led to a whole theory of art proposed by the philosopher Arthur Danto, in which he talks about the end of art history, because you can't really tell just by looking at something if it's art or not, was his argument. And he really thinks of Warhol as provoking this question even more than Duchamp did earlier in the 20th century. Another letter from Campbell's Soup. This was after the Brillo box show had closed. It's from 1964, very soon afterwards. And apparently, Billy Naim, who was one of the major assistants for Warhol in his studio, The Factory, had written to Campbell's Soup and offered to sell them some Campbell's Soup boxes. You may have noticed in that last image that in the foreground, they're all Campbell's Soup boxes. And so an offer was being made to the company to see if they were interested in purchasing some of the boxes. And the letter, the same person that wrote earlier in 64 said, well, we of course have followed he puts it in quotation marks, the Campbell experience in the world of art, as you describe it. And we're pleased that there's so much interest in Mr. Warhol's work. He goes on to say, if we were to sponsor or display these works of art in any way, however, it might interject an element of commercialism into the whole project that would detract from their acceptance as works of art. Now, 2 years later, they're going to market a dress, you know, based on this. So they, you know, maybe this guy lost his job because of this letter. He didn't follow up on it. But he does say, in any event, while we appreciate you offering us these tomato juice carton sculptures, wood sculptures, we cannot at this time purchase them. So this, you know, supposed dilemma they had about conflict of interest. That label that James Harvey designs, that Warhol appropriates and essentially makes his own, has itself recycled and been appropriated. Deitch Projects in New York, one of the premier contemporary art spaces, has used it as a logo for many years. It's a reflective window that this has been taken through. That's why it looks this way on the left. It's right by their door. But it's essentially the logo based on the Brillo box. So just as Warhol appropriated it, they've appropriated it. It appears as the design element on a very recent book on art and text. And so again, this entering into the world of commerce, into the world of advertising, back into the world of popular culture. Wanted to conclude with a few images of Warhol himself appearing as a spokesman. And Warhol really engaged in this in the late 60s and particularly the 70s. He talked about being a business artist, that art was a business and that's what he was going to do. In 1968, he placed an ad in the Village Voice in New York. And let me read you, this is what the ad said. I'll endorse with my name any of the following: clothing, AC/DC, cigarettes, small tapes, sound equipment, rock and roll records in capital letters, anything, film and film equipment, food, helium whips money. Love and kisses, Andy Warhol, EL59941. Give me a call. So he is willing to do this. It's also in the 70s, a little known fact that Warhol, actually, late 70s actually, Warhol sells his soul and receive an official document from the two Russian conceptual artists who came out of Russian pop art, Komar and Melamed. They had a project where they were offering to buy people's souls, and Warhol actually gave them his soul. They sold it in Russia, and Warhol was really disappointed because it got 30 rubles, and he thought that was... an ironic headline for the Newsweek, No Gossip. Of course, Warhol's all about gossip. He's already started 10 years earlier, almost, Interview Magazine. Penthouse Forum featured a big interview with Andy Warhol. Sony Betamax. These are great ads because, you know, they bring back things that we... forgotten existed, you know, Betamax and things like that. And then, you know, bizarrely, since he wore a wig, Vidal Sassoon hairspray. All of, you know, this is all very calculated, of course, because this kind of advertising campaign is not a lark. It's all very demographically controlled and so forth. And they knew Warhol had a certain cachet among a certain audience. And Warhol himself saw it as a way of promoting himself, of keeping himself advertised. I mean, he becomes his own advertisement. And then a really remarkable image, particularly as for Drexel Burnham, which went bankrupt soon after this ad appeared, or at least got in big trouble. Warhol sitting in front of a version of the painting that's the self-portraits in the collection here.